Hi, everyone. Everyone here is all right? Cool. I'm going to introduce Nabs now. I'm Imran. I'm an artist who's interested in music and stuff. And Nabs is basically a superhero.
Thanks.
Nabs is NTS resident, Ninja Tune signee, new album out, Weighing of the Heart, black belt in karate, yeah. Trained barrister.
Yeah.
And what else? And you just got mad skills, isn't it?
Yeah, that's about it. That's about it.
That's loads, bro. That's loads. That's a lifetime's worth. I guess we should start off at the beginning and thinking about your childhood influences. It'd be a good place to start, I think.
The beginning, yeah. Well, my mum's in the audience, so she'll probably be able to tell the story better than me. My first musical obsession was Michael Jackson, and that was from a really young age. Maybe like I was one or something. And my parents had taped this Michael Jackson documentary off the television. And I watched that tape so much that the VHS completely wore out. And then I freaked out because I couldn't watch it anymore. And so then my uncle went out and bought like another Michael Jackson video. And then I remember that one really vividly. I used to watch it every day as well, I think. Like just dance and sing along. And yeah, I mean, he's still my most... Like, he's my favourite musical icon, for sure. And that's where it all started.
Yeah, I think it started for a lot of kids of the 80s with MJ.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I think in my family, it was a similar deal, really. There was my dad, at the time, he was writing for Time Out and stuff, doing music reviews, so he had to review Michael Jackson. So we had all kinds of records.
I hope it was a good review.
Yeah, of course, man. We had all kinds of records knocking about the house, but... Do you want to introduce this one in particular?
Yeah, so we had to start with Michael Jackson because otherwise this whole thing wouldn't make sense to me. And I've picked out... Well, I wanted to play like one of the big hits, but then I thought actually it might be more interesting to play one that maybe not everyone here has heard before. And it's the original home demo recording of Don't Stop Till You Get Enough, which Michael recorded at home with all his siblings. It's proper like rough and ready. They're all playing... percussion on like glass bottles with spoons and things like that, and you can hear it all. And the reason why I love it so much is because you know, this is like the demo version of this song, which is now one of the biggest hits of all time, and he's at home and he's doing it and everything's there in terms of like all the arrangement and the ideas. He hasn't thought of the lyrics yet and he's kind of like singing without words, but it just shows what a visionary he was, you know? Because you think, oh, maybe when he went into the studio with Quincy, that's when they, like, put in this bit and that bit and the bass line, but it didn't happen like that at all, and this proves it.
We're gonna be starting now, baby. Don't stop till you get enough. Don't stop till you get enough. Don't stop.
Good, right? It feels like special to hear it. You can almost, it feels like a window into his house back in the day, and them lot all just having a massive jam session. Yeah.
So I guess we should jump ahead a bit, lest we just play Michael Jackson all night.
Yeah, we could have done that. We could have easily done that.
And think about your teenage years, because I think for me personally, that was like the time when you kind of like start to really become a muso and like dig deep.
Yeah, the formative years.
Yeah, the formative years. And I think, funnily enough, we had like quite a similar taste around that time. But I was living in deep south and you were living in north, is that
right? Yeah, that's right. But so we're probably at some gigs at the same time.
Maybe. So, where were you living? You were in north
near Regent's
River.
Park, yeah.
Okay.
Regent's Park, St. John's Wood. And luckily it was pretty close to Camden. So I was there like every weekend. So I started with Michael Jackson, but then I guess when I got a bit older, my next musical obsession was Oasis. And then after that, just got more into like guitar-y and grungy music. And then just became like, you don't even see those kids anymore, you know, like everyone was called a grunger back then, do you know? Yeah, but you don't even see anyone from that sort of style tribe anymore. But anyway, I was one of those kids, just wearing loads of jewellery and really baggy trousers and dyed my hair loads of different colours. And
jeans that like covered all of your shoe.
Yeah.
Remember them, they were
criminal damage jeans. Yeah. And then we just, me and my mates used to hang out in Camden every weekend, and we'd always go to the Underworld for like ska punk gigs. And that's obviously like pre-internet times, so it was really important to go to the gig and then pick up the flyers from people outside the gig afterwards to find out about the next gig. And yeah, I think I've got a scrapbook somewhere with all my tickets. Should have brought that along, like show and tell.
So what kind of bands were you listening to?
I guess I got, Cap Down, which is the band we're going to hear next, they were my favourite band at that time when I was about 13, and they're like a ska punk band. And then I got into stuff like, I guess, Less Than Jake and Green Day and Real Big Fish and Bouncing Souls and like that whole era of music.
Sponge, you remember Sponge?
Yeah, Sponge. And we went to Deconstruction Festival, that was quite good, if anyone else was at that. It's like a ska punk festival, it was pretty good.
Should we play Pound for the Sound?
Yeah, but yeah, you've got it. Oh, you got it ready. I didn't even realise.
Sneaky,
yeah. So this is Cap Town, Pound for the Sound. And I wish I'd brought the CD in for the album, because I wrote a letter to their record label back in the day and was like, Cap Town are my favourite band and I really want to have their autograph, so please could you send it to me? And they sent me a CD with a signed out, like the album sleeve was all signed, and I was really happy. I should also say that I think it's the first time I've listened to that track really since I was 13, when I was putting all the track lists together for this talk. So it's like a proper blast from the past.
And that scene was so jokes as well. I remember like that tune Sell Out by Real Big Fish. That was like the tune.
Yeah, I remember that tune too.
But yeah, I never raved in Camden, sadly.
Oh, I saw Real Big Fish at Electric Ballroom actually.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. My first gig was at the Astoria, and that doesn't even exist anymore, which is a bit sad.
I remember the Astoria.
Yeah, I went to see the Wannadies, the Swedish band.
Nice.
Yeah, they were like a one-hit wonder, because they had that song that was in the Romeo and Juliet film. Does anyone remember? It's just me and you always.
And forever. Yeah. That one, yeah, that's a big tune. I get to play one tune every time we do this, so I'm going to take my opportunity to play one singular tune. Because I always remember that they used to call this kind of music like third wave ska, and the second wave was Big in My House, so like Two Tone and Go Feet, and a lot of labels from like the Midlands and Coventry that were doing ska music in like late 70s, early 80s. So I'm gonna play this one because I'm feeling mad sentimental, and this was my parents' first dance at their wedding.
So cute. Yeah, he told me this before. I was like, wow, you had cool parents.
They were jokes. let me play this tune.
Yeah.
She's mine. So that was Hands Off, She's Mine by The Beat. Great tune, great album, man. So yeah, let's move on from various waves of ska. I don't know what wave they're on now. Like wave
I don't
eight.
Know is it, if it's still a thing, but when I was looking up Cap Down, I saw they put out another album in 2007.
Did they?
I
Someone's still into
one.
It.
Yeah.
So after your teenagers, you went to SOAS, is that right?
Yeah, so after school, yeah, I went to uni at SOAS, the School of Oriental and African Studies, here in University of London, and I applied to do just history, BA, but before the term started, they had this special induction week, and during that, I went to this performance that the music department put on, and it was of a kora player, kora's West African harp, and it was completely new to me, because I mean, obviously music has always been my favorite thing growing up, and I've like just spent so much time digging for tunes and exploring stuff, but I'd never come across this instrument before or this sound, and it was obviously very different to how like world music is packaged to us anyway, which is like complete rubbish, I think. When I saw this kora player playing his harp, I just was, I don't know, like stunned. So I tracked down the head of the ethnomusicology department, and then I went to see her, and I was like, you don't know who I am, and I just applied to do history, but please let me on the ethnomusicology course. And it kind of worked in my favour. I didn't realise that her specialisation was West African music, so I was like gushing about the kora. So I guess in her mind, she was like, oh, who's this person? But anyway, yeah, so she let me on the course, and that's how I ended up studying joint honours in history and ethnomusicology. I think I was the only person doing that combination of degree.
Ever.
Yeah, maybe ever. But I'm glad I did it. It makes sense now why I did it. And that whole process of studying ethnomusicology just broadened my musical horizons so much, because it was the first time that I was exposed to all these different musics and cultures from around the world. And I got the chance to not only like study about them, but then also try and learn some of the instruments. So in first year, I had to do Turkish ensemble, and I thought I'd take up the ney, which is the Turkish reed flute, because I already played the like Western classical flute, so I thought it would be an easy transition. But it took me about 3 months to even make a sound. So then like I had to just, the teacher was just like, I think maybe you should just do something else, like the drumming or something. But then, and then I did gamelan, which is Indonesian percussion, the Javanese and Balinese. But like my group of friends in my gamelan class that I was mates with, they were always like, oh God, gamelan. And with them, I'd always be like, yeah, just kind of making fun of it. But secretly, I loved it so much. So I did all the extra gamelan classes. And then at the end of the year, there was a special performance at the Royal Festival Hall, and I was in it. And then they were like, what? Nabia, why are you doing that? But then, yes, then the cat was out of the bag. But gamelan music is so incredible, and especially because Indonesia is such a huge place, 17,000 islands, and they all have their own percussion ensembles, and it varies so much. So if you haven't heard that type of music, I would highly recommend checking it out. Javanese is more chilled, Balinese is more intense. And yeah, that's like the kind of basic dichotomy. And my main instrument that I studied was the sitar. I still play it a bit. I did a performance last year on it, actually. And that, again, was like another opening or another channel into the world of music, because it's an oral tradition, so there's no written notation or anything like that. And the way that you approach music and study the instrument is so different to how I was taught how to play like the flute and the guitar and piano recorder growing up. North Indian classical tradition, which is based on ragas, and ragas are the name for the scales in that tradition. Each scale is associated with a specific time of day, a specific feeling or mood, emotions, colours, and that's how you describe the sound of the music. And it's so different to being like, oh, so what's the key signature of like D major? You better learn it. You've got to learn it, but you've got to learn it without looking at like black and white notation on a piece of paper. It's about feeling your way through it. And yeah, it's amazing.
Is that an approach that you've sort of clung to, or that you've developed, do you think, in what you've been making recently?
I think so, for sure. It just makes you realise that the music, the power of music is so huge, and we're just tapping into a tiny bit of it. But there's so much to be gained from trying to, like, just surrendering yourself to the sound and to, like, the feelings that come with it. I think there's something also special about a lot of those, like, those instruments where you have to sit on the ground to play them, and you can't wear shoes, and you've got to respect the instruments. They're all made still by traditional means. So my sitar, the bottom of it, the gourd, the big round bit at the bottom, is made out of a dried pumpkin. Then obviously you've got the neck, which is wooden, and, you know, there's no, like, substitutions, there's no plastic in it and nothing like that. And I think all of those little details add up and make a big difference.
So maybe this is a good time to play the maestro.
Yeah,
the sitar. I need to maestro,
cue it up. You've got to talk for a sec.
Okay. So we're going to play a tune by Ravi Shankar, yeah, who I only found out recently is Norah Jones's old man. Did you know that? How mad is that?
Makes sense, though.
Her estranged father. So the talent runs deep.
So this is a track from this album. Oh, yeah, this is actually a birthday present from my mum. Thanks. It's an album called Improvisations, and it's Ravi Shankar and Yehudi Menuhin, the world famous violinist. And the reason why I like this record is because you've got the sitar, and the whole sound of the music is like North Indian, but then you've got this amazing violinist who's kind of like trying to adopt that style as well and playing violin in that way, and it works. I mean, sitar pieces are always really long, so I feel bad fading it out, but that was just the beginning section, which is called the alap, which is just free rhythm improvisation. We didn't make it to the rhythmic section, but anyway, that track's called Twilight Mood, if you want to listen to it yourselves later. Yeah.
So let's continue going chronologically for now. So after SOAS, you got yourself educated to some insane degree, and went to Cambridge. Yeah. And did you do history? Is that right? You did history.
Yeah. So after I graduated from SOAS, I then went to Cambridge and did an MPhil, specialising in South African history, and in particular, I was looking at the political role of the black press during apartheid. And I studied about South Africa during my undergrad degree at SOAS, and then the summer after I studied there, I went on a family holiday to South Africa, and it was the first time I'd ever been to a country after really studying about it, and it made such a difference, you know. And I was just, because I'm also like a massive history geek, so we went to South Africa and I was like, oh my God, because it's all the places that I'd been reading about in the textbooks, and I was there, and obviously, like, you could also have really good conversations with people because apartheid only ended in 1994, so it's still a really recent thing. And there's still a lot of, like, racial divides there. So that's what sparked my interest in South Africa. And then I went to Cambridge and then did this MPhil. I had to do a 30,000-word dissertation.
Bloody
which
up.
was so intense. I remember, like, printing it out on the last day for submission. You know, when it comes out, the photocopier, and then you see how many pages it takes up, then it, like, yeah, kind of hits you. Anyway, and then during that year, I went out to South Africa to do research for my master's. I interviewed loads of veteran, like, journalists and black consciousness activists, and looked through all the newspaper archives there. Sure. And so, yeah, the interest just continued because after that, I came back to London. I did the law conversion course and then the bar. And the day after I got called to the bar, I travelled back out to South Africa to do a placement with a group of human rights lawyers in Cape Town, focusing on women's rights. And that was... It was an amazing experience, but it was quite hard. Mm. It was quite hard, especially at the beginning, because you're going into, you know, the kinds of cases that we were dealing with every day was just really intense. Like doing women's rights in a place like that where there's really high levels of violence against women, like sexual violence and other problems, really put stuff into perspective.
Sure. But it was also around this time that you started DJing as well, is that right?
Yeah, I think I started DJing in my Cambridge year. And sure. Then whilst I was at back in London at City doing the law conversion and the bar, at the same time, like, putting on loads of parties with my friends. It started out as a series of parties in laundrettes. That's where I first started DJing. And I had a group of mates who would just go, I don't know how they managed to do it, but just, like, hire out a laundrette on a Saturday night and then just... take in a sound system and just like have a massive party in there all night. I think they just offer the laundrette owners like a few hundred quid and they just probably didn't understand like what was going on. Yeah, but that's the first place I ever DJed during those parties.
And were you DJing in SA as well?
Yeah, so whilst I was in South Africa at that time, yeah, I had two very different experiences. Obviously the legal work, which was very demanding and like emotionally and intellectually, and then also this music side where I was DJing a lot of parties and collaborating with local artists and trying to discover as much as I could about the local South African music scenes. Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, it was...
Lawyer by day, DJ by night. You are a superhero, yeah. Man. Super nabs.
Who else is it? Isn't Judge Jules that DJ? He's like now a lawyer as well.
Is it?
Yeah. The name.
Hence the name.
Yeah. I think that was his DJ name, and then he was like, oh, I'll do it for real.
Oh, wow. So I guess...
Also, George Fitzgerald, you know that DJ? He's on Radio 1. He's also a lawyer, or was a lawyer. So there's a few.
Unlike Bobby Friction and Nihal, like they've got like side hustles as well, but they're like deep side hustles.
Yeah, I think everyone needs a side hustle at least at the beginning, and then you've got to like see whether you can live off the music or not.
Your side hustles are ridiculous. Your side hustles are being a human
rights
lawyer.
My side hustle at school was a karate teacher, which is pretty good as well.
I don't even have a side hustle, man. My side hustle is this. So let's play a tune from South Africa.
Yeah, so this is some Zulu jazz from South Africa. It's from 1976. It's got amazing artwork. The band's called Batsumi, and this is a track called Lishonile. And, you know, we forget that there's so much good jazz from places outside of Europe and America. I don't know, because, yeah, most of the time people, when they think about jazz, you just automatically think about American jazz, but the South African jazz is pretty good too. Again, gotta fade it, but please listen to it. The band is called Batsumi, and this whole record is incredible, actually. The next tune is it's by a Nigerian band called Nkegas, and the album is Destruction, and this is old, like, Nigerian Afrobeat, and not all of them, but a lot of the most expensive records I've got in my collection I acquired by accident or as a present, and this is one of them. It's like only the last one that sold on Discogs was £1,000. So I don't really take it out like for DJ sets anymore. And I got this from my boyfriend's dad's record collection. He used to be a DJ back in the day, and I was going through his stuff and then picked out a few. And then he said that I could keep them because it was my birthday. And then when I told him how much it was on Discogs, he was like, I better go through the rest. But yeah.
Watch out for the front row there too. Thank you. I don't want to fade it out on another solo.
Yeah, you just fade it out of the set. It's like, sozul, but it's fine. It's okay. I was DJing that track. I was DJing at a party and De La Soul turned up, no pressure. And then I played that track and Mace, the DJ from De La Soul, asked me for a track ID. I was like, that is pretty good. When someone who's that good at DJing is asking you what track you're playing.
Especially now that it's worth a grand.
Yeah. On Discogs, whatever price anyone makes up, that's just like the set
rate.
Price. Yeah, it just doesn't really make sense, to be honest.
So you were recently in Egypt.
Yeah, 2 weeks ago. Has anyone in this room been to Egypt? Oh yeah, quite a few. So insane.
You will have to tell the story about meeting someone down the...
Oh yes,
in the pyramids.
You just told the story.
No, I kind of told the story.
Yeah, no, I went to Egypt. It was my first time there, and it was such an amazing trip and an important trip for me because I'm really, really interested in ancient Egyptian history and culture. So it was just great to see the pyramids in real life. I thought seeing them in real life would help the whole thing to make more sense to me, but now it just makes even less sense because I just don't understand like how they made all that stuff. But yeah, anyway, we went inside a couple of pyramids and went inside the Red Pyramid, which is the second biggest pyramid in Egypt. And inside the pyramid, I bumped into someone that I know, who's actually another one of the Somerset House Studios residents. And it was like, I was going down the tunnel, right? So it's a really long shaft, it's 650 meters long. And I was halfway down and I'd stopped because sometimes I get really claustrophobic. So I was just kind of like sitting on the side trying to pump myself up to do the next bit. And there's these two girls coming down from behind me. So I just shouted back to them, I'm just sitting here, you guys can go past me. And then I heard a voice from behind me like, is that Nabiha down there? And I just freaked out. Because what are the chances? And also the daylight was behind them, so they were dark. I couldn't see who it was. And it turned out to be Lillian, who's one of the artists here. And it was just so freaky. I think we need to collab.
Absolutely insane. And like you've got more, it's hilarious, you've got more chance of bumping into Lily in a pyramid than in Morden, which is where she lives.
Yeah, I'll never go to Morden.
Deep south. So yeah, maybe we should play, because you collect as you travel.
Yeah, so one of my favourite things to do whenever I travel to a new country is to just try and buy some music from that place, make some field recordings, because, you know, a lot of the stuff that you're going to find in each of those countries is going to be really difficult to find that stuff back home. And yeah, so that's part of what I do. And also because of the radio show that I present on NTS, where from time to time I do like geographical shows and they're all based on trips that I've done. So the last one this week was on Egypt and I played a bunch of field recordings that I made out there and also some records that I found. And I want to share one of them with you. Yeah, I found a couple of really good record stores in Cairo, actually, so if anyone needs any tips, let me know. But this is an old oud solo. The oud is the Arabic lute, and I think it's definitely one of my favourite sounds out of all the instruments.
Do you want to fade it out so I don't kill the solo again?
The whole thing's a solo.
All right, okay, cool.
Playing so fast. Wow. The oud player there is called Zakaria Suleiman, and he's playing Takasim Hijaz. I guess that's just the name of the scale that he's playing. Yeah.
We're going to stick geographical for a bit. Palin-ing the shit out of this. We're going to go to Turkey now.
Yeah, Turkey. I thought I'd play some Turkish disco for you guys. This is always a floor filler when I play DJ sets out in the club. So it's by a group called Parallel Disco, and the track's called Egri Bugru. I don't know if I'm saying that right.
Mm-hmm.
How so good, isn't it? It's like quite a slow tempo, but whenever I play it, when I'm DJing out in a nightclub, like it makes everybody dance. But I think it's because of the bass line is so driving.
It's a naughty, naughty bass line. So let's go back to London now. And I guess preface this by saying, as evinced by your record collection, you are probably the most dedicated crate digger that I know.
Oh, right, thanks.
Yeah, man, it's a full-time job.
Yeah, it also used up all my money.
Yeah. but there's a particular bargain bin that you like, isn't there?
Yeah, there is.
Or maybe you don't, because there's bangers
in
there.
Yeah, I know, there are bangers in there, one of which I will share next. Zen Records in Seven Sisters. Does anybody know that record store? I really like going to the ones that are a bit more off the beaten track, you know, because obviously, well, I love the ones in Soho, like Fonica and Sounds the Universe, and like, you know, everyone who runs those stores is super friendly, and it's always like a good way to find new music and new releases, re-releases. But I also really like going to just the random ones that are just really time warped, you know, because you just know they've been around and like you're praying that they won't shut down. You turn up one day and it will be gone, although that might happen. And one of my favourite ones is Zen Records in Tottenham. And the guy who runs it, Rob, is cool. But every time I go in there, you have to just like have at least 3 hours spare. One, because there's loads of stuff to go through, but two, because he talks so much. And he's and then but then I always kind of humour him, because then I want him to give me a discount. He's like, oh, you always do this to me every time. But then like and like he always puts on a front about it, but then I manage to get a discount, so it's all right.
Off a vinyl that costs 50p.
No, not these ones, not these ones. So anyway, but there's a bargain box in there where everything's 50p. So after I've like made all my selections of what I want, I have like an extra fiver and pick out 10 records from the bargain bin, and he refuses to play them because they're only 50p each. But sometimes you get a gem.
A gem.
And this is one of them. I actually got a first pressing of Electric Ladyland in that store. I paid like 50 or 60 quid for it, which is actually a pretty good bargain. That was off Azuli Records. The track's called Rockin' Music. It's really good. I haven't been able to find it anywhere online. Well, last time I checked, maybe it's up somewhere now. But so good. 50p well spent.
Yeah. So let's play another one of the ones you've unearthed at Zen Records.
This is from another unknown record store.
Okay, all right.
But not Zen Records. It's actually one that's round the corner from my flat. And like, I only discovered it last year. I just didn't even know it was there. It's one of those shops where, you know, from the outside, you just can't tell what's going on inside. And so I just know, you know, just one of those mysterious shops. And it doesn't have a sign. But it turns out to be an amazing record store. And I live right behind Abbey Road Studios, which is cool but also annoying, because that is the worst zebra crossing in the whole of London. Just got like a million tourists all the time. But yeah, so this store is behind there too, and it's run by these two old guys who are like obviously like young, hip guys in the 60s, because they will always have a lot of stories for me about that era as well. And they sell a lot of... they sell a lot of like old guitar music. They've got loads of Beatles stuff, but if I'm honest, I haven't ever really got into the Beatles. But they always have like a lot of Jimi Hendrix. And Jimi Hendrix is one of my favourite ever musicians. And I got this recently. It's the original soundtrack to the film Rainbow Bridge that he did. And there's a track on it called Pally Gap. And it's my current favourite track. I listen to it on repeat every morning really loud. And I don't have to worry about annoying my neighbours, because they are also really loud and musical, and their son plays the trombone, and it's...
Payback.
I just want to tell him to just take up a different instrument, you know? and also, he always wants to practice at, like, 9 p.m, so after I've done, like, a whole day in the studio, and then this is, like, just blasting out through the whole street. Anyway, that's off on a tangent, but yeah, this is a little record store on Violet Hill, if anyone's interested, and the guys who run it are really cool. They're always like, help yourself to a bunch of 7 inches on the way out, and like, that's yeah, cute. It's quite, and when I like went in and bought loads of Jimmy stuff the other day, and then they gave me a little Jimi Hendrix magnet as well, which is cute. They don't do that in Sounds of the Universe. I really didn't want to fade. also, you know, well, maybe you guys all know, you can go to Jimi Hendrix's flat in Mayfair. They opened it up last year or the year before. Do you know that? And they've redone his bedroom. It's like all the original stuff. And then they even have the piece of paper with the lyrics for Voodoo Child on it.
Oh, wow.
They wrote. Yeah, so if any of you are Jimi Hendrix fans, you should definitely check it out. And his rent in Mayfair, like in the 60s, whenever he moved in, it was like £8 a week.
Wow.
And then they said that he walked up to John Lewis. It's like off Bond Street. It's on Brook Street. And Handel's flat is also in the same building. So it's like two musical geniuses, but 300 years apart. Or, yeah, wow. 400 years apart. And they said that Jimmy went up to John Lewis on Oxford Street to choose all the carpets and the curtains. And I'm like, I'm just trying to imagine Jimi Hendrix and John Lewis in the upholstery section.
Yeah.
So
before we play a tune of yours off the new album, this is a good time, I guess, to play one last absolute all-timer. And I'll let you introduce it, but I think it's important because you do a really good cover of this tune. So take it away.
The next tune I'm going to play is by The Cure, who are one of my favourite bands, and it's a Forest. I've listened to this track countless amount of times, and every time I listen to it, it just still sounds better and better to me. You know, I haven't got sick of it, and I think it's really rare to come across a tune like that in your life, but this is one of them. And yeah, me and Max, my bandmate who's sitting over there, we do a cover of this in the live show. Yeah, if anyone's around tomorrow, we're actually doing a little free live show at Queen Elizabeth Hall across the river at 5:30 p.m. If you want to see us play a cover of
Are
the
you gonna
Forest.
Play this tune?
Yeah.
Great.
I just also thought of something that I should tell you guys about. There's a really good version of the Cure doing that song on YouTube. You should watch it. It's a video of them doing it at this German festival in the early 80s. And I think the whole lineup's running late, so they're trying to cut their set short. And then they just, like, the Cure just refused to stop playing that song. Like, it's starting to end, and then they kind of all go in a huddle. And I think Robert Smith's telling the others, like, no, let's just keep going. Because, I don't know, they were probably just trying to annoy the festival organisers or the next band, but it's such a good version. So, yeah, you should just search that up.
That's just randomly reminded me of one of the worst moments in my life. Right. Where I was stuck in a rave. Do you remember that tune with Miss Dynamite and DJ Zinc?
Yeah.
Do you remember that tune? I can't remember what it's called. Anyway, the CDJ broke. And it looped the same 16 bars of that tune for like pretty much like the length of this fella's set. And by the end, it was honestly, it was purgatory. It was one of the most horrendous moments of my life. But now I just cannot hear that tune. It's like when I hear Miss Dynamite, it's so sad because she's so sick. But yeah. When I hear Miss Dynamite, it's like, I just my whole body just goes into like catatonic shock.
It's weird how that DJ just carried on. Just stood there.
They were all freaking out, and there was no sound engineer there. So, is always the way when you're raving in a laundrette or wherever else, and it was just stuck. So yeah. Anyway, I've got chills just thinking about that.
Maybe we should play that song now.
Oh mate, that would have been great. But I think instead what we should do is play a tune of your new album. And so, hit play, bro.
All right.
Let's do it.
So Saw You Twice. Off the album Weighing of the Heart.
Thank you, Nabs.
Thanks, Imran.
Give it up.